Hartwell, Ms. Burrows, and Mr. Obenshain. Mr. Obenshain, welcome.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, judges.
Good morning, Ms. Burrows. Would you like to reserve any of your 15 minutes for rebuttal?
I can reserve 3 minutes.
All right, that'll be fine.
And judges, just before we get started, I did want to advise the court that Mr. Hicklin's mother and his fiance and another family member are both here this morning on
his
behalf. So just want to make the court aware of that.
All right, you may begin when you're ready.
Thank you. Again, good morning, judges. My name is Joan Burrows. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Hicklin this morning, the appellant in this matter. We have two assignments of error that we're asking the court to address. They both call for different remedies, so I'll address those remedies as we get there. But the two errors that are alleged here is, first and foremost, the information about Ms. Harkless's pending charges in Hopewell is information that should have been turned over pursuant to Brady. The second issue is that the evidence was insufficient to prove that he actually possessed the firearm.
Let me stop you on the Brady issue.
Sure.
I want to parse, I guess, how we analyze that. So let's start with the issue of whether or not that information is exculpatory in the first place.
Yes.
Can we agree that there's evidence in the record that there was no plea agreement, no arrangement for in return? So it's simply the existence of pending charges as to whether that's Brady material or not.
Right, and I think what kind of sets this case apart is the nature of those pending charges. I think if this had been an additional petty larceny, or if this had been an additional assault and battery or something like that, but I think the fact that this is actually a firearms charge.
Except we have this quaint notion in our jurisprudence that you're innocent until proven guilty.
Certainly.
And if there's no agreement in place for consideration of those charges, which would clearly implicate Brady, I don't have any question about that, then is the mere fact that you have pending charges that you're presumptively innocent of fall within Brady? And maybe you can point us to some authority that suggests that that is in fact the case, but frankly, I couldn't find any.
Well, I think, Judge, what the case that I find most helpful is Banks versus Commonwealth, which I cited to in my brief, 16 VA appellate 959, and certainly that's not pending charges, it's unadjudicated bad acts, essentially. In that case, it was a police officer, I believe, was acting as an informant. The defense attorney was cut off from being able to examine him about unadjudicated bad acts. He was never charged with those things, but they were bad acts nonetheless. And so I think when you're facing criminal charges, especially charges that would render a reasonable hypothesis of innocence, as it would in this case, the Banks case falls in line and shows us that even if it's unadjudicated, even if you've not been convicted, it's still Brady because it's impeachable.
But is it impeachable? I mean, Workman, how do you get around the language of the Supreme Court's decision in Workman, which says that even if information is admissible, even if information is material under Brady, if it would not lead to admissible impeachment evidence, it doesn't have to be disclosed.
Well, I think it is admissible. I think that...
Please tell me how pending charges of which you're presumptively innocent of would ever be admissible to impeach a witness.
Well, again, I think the Banks case stands for the proposition if we can cross-examine on unadjudicated bad acts, I think you can certainly cross-examine on pending charges. Because it gives us the right to say, well, don't you have these charges pending? And especially in this case, you're charged with being in the presence of a firearm in these cases and handling a firearm in those cases. That turns, in this case, into the trial court actually spoke in his ruling on, I believe it was the motion to strike. He talks about, at the joint appendix at 123, Judge Jenkins opines, unless she had a gun and fired it into her own car, then there was no basis for the motion to strike. There was no basis to find him not guilty. These charges lead us to the possibility that exactly could have happened. So certainly if she's not been convicted of those charges, that's something the Commonwealth can rehabilitate on redirect. But I think that that information should have been available to the defense attorney to go over in his cross-examination. I think it completely changes the color of the case at that point. And certainly we don't have to prove that it would have changed the outcome, but it certainly would have changed the color of the case. It could have changed defense's preparation for the case and the way the defense counsel handled this case. So I think with all of that in mind, that's why this information is so important. I think it's critical that the court be presented with that information and that information come out in its whole and not in parts like it did in this case.
Counsel, when I read your brief, and particularly I suppose when I read the responsive brief by the Commonwealth, I thought this case was going to be more significant on the issue of the unresolved question in Delville.
Yes, Judge. And I think that is kind of, that to me was the unique aspect of this case. Because what Delville said is, as the court knows, if is a bench trial and the trial court says, I've heard this evidence, it's not going to change my mind, then we're left with a Brady issue problem. We're left with the fact that in that case, it may not be a Brady violation. What's different here is in Delville, they did not address the fact that that decision by the trial court was reasonable or unreasonable. Mm-hmm. That's what this court said. That's why it was not addressed. So I think what Delville stands for is that while the trial court's entitled to make that decision, it doesn't protect the trial court from being reviewed for reasonableness.
That's correct.
And so my issue here and my contention here is that the Giglio case that I cited in my brief that I'm sure the court is well aware of, it's indicates that it is an abuse of discretion because here we have a prime witness for the Commonwealth, the only eyewitness to the case, and we are left without critical information that can go to her credibility as a witness.
Tell me how we would write this case in addressing the unresolved issue in Delville and concluding that in fact in this case it was unreasonable for the trial court to draw the conclusion that it did.
Well, I think Giglio says that it's unreasonable.
You say per se?
I don't think per se, but I think that there is an analysis that attaches to Giglio, where in Giglio you have a prime witness, information about that witness's credibility is kept from the defense attorney, was not allowed to be cross-examined. This is the exact same situation here. We have a prime witness, the only eyewitness to the case, information that could lead to a reasonable hypothesis of innocence as well as bias on the part of that witness is kept from the defense counsel. Again, the nature, I think what, again, sets this case apart is the nature of these charges pending against her. The fact that she's charged with discharging a firearm puts her in a unique position where she is inclined to be biased and can be impeached on that bias because she has incentive to distance herself from a firearm. She has incentive to seek protection based on those pending charges. She didn't ultimately get that protection, but I think that's something that could have been fleshed out in cross-examination had we known this ahead of time. But she has a lot of incentives not to tell the truth because of that pending charge. And so I think, based on that, going through the Giglio analysis, that's how this court resolves the Delville issue and resolves the kind of takes the extra step that Delville was not able to take because it was not preserved in that record. So, additionally, judges, I think one of the other issues, obviously, that we have to talk about is whether this information was suppressed. I know the Commonwealth has argued in its brief that this information was public information because it was within the courts. I'll just simply state, judges, I think that I realize the defense attorneys are required to do due diligence in exploring the Commonwealth's witnesses and what information is out there, but to ask the defense attorney to go through, I think I did a quick count yesterday, it's around 161 different courts that we would be required to check into. I think that goes a bit above and beyond what we're required to do.
There's public records and then there's public records. Huh?
Yes, Judge. So I would state that the Commonwealth's position on that point, I think, is a bit extreme. So, and I would ask the court as a practicing trial counsel to not make that our requirement. So,
with the internet, you can do it very quickly.
That is correct. It makes it a little bit easier, but not still rather an impossible task. But I think what's important to keep in mind is looking at the entire picture with this Brady issue. Again, I said at the beginning that this would be different if it was just a simple petty larceny charge or some additional charge that was not directly connected to this case. But where she's charged with having a firearm, and that firearms charge can make her biased and make her more likely to not tell the truth, I think that's something the Commonwealth has to turn over. Certainly, had they turned that over, we could have cross-examined her on it, and she could have been fully rehabilitated.
Tell me what the logic is if you have a pending charge in another jurisdiction, how that would make you more inclined not to tell the truth.
Well,
it seems to me to be the opposite if you're looking for consideration.
Well, I think the Banks case actually does a great job of fleshing out why that's a problem. In that case, where they're talking about why it was a problem for the defense counsel not to be able to cross-examine the police informant, or I think it was actually a police officer who was an informant, It says there that if believed, the trier of fact could reasonably infer from the defendant's proffered evidence that the confidential informant had a strong motive to implicate the defendant in order to conceal his own alleged drug dealing activities, to distract the police from suspecting that he was distributing drugs, to persuade the police he was not doing so, or to gain immunity from them for his own misdeeds. And so I think you kind of can draw the same conclusion here. She's charged with a firearms possession charge, something that requires the Commonwealth to show that she's in possession of a gun charge. So I think she would be loath to come to court and tell the truth about something that could put a firearm in her hand or could put her close to a firearm.
It did come out that there was a charge of filing a false police report.
Yes.
And the trial court commented about that and said that had much more impact on his view of her potential credibility than on the charges which were not disclosed. So in this case, we're not left with all outstanding charges never being disclosed.
Sure.
That there was an issue of credibility on the basis of this one incident, correct?
Correct. But I do
Does
think...
Does that alter the analysis at all?
Well, I think what kind of becomes a problem is the court saying that, but then again, at page 123, where he's making his ruling and says, unless she had a gun and fired into her own car. So I think, obviously, his decision on the motion to strike, and I think that they rolled the motion to strike into his closing argument at trial, clearly there was some concern on the court's part that if there was evidence that she had discharged her own gun, then that would maybe alter the outcome. And I think that right there points us to the fact that despite what the trial court said later on, and mind you, this is something that happened, this additional sentencing hearing or the additional Brady hearing happened a couple months later. So I think, though, right at the time, at the trial court says very specifically, if there was information about X, and now all of a sudden we find out after from the Commonwealth, or not from the Commonwealth, but because the trial counsel happened to be in the right place at the right time, there is information about X. And I think that makes it fairly clear that this is Brady information. It should have made a difference in the trial court's mind. I think for the trial court to find otherwise is unreasonable, and that's why I do think it is differentiable, and it is an extension of the double case that would allow us to kind of close that gap, as it were.
What effect do you think the Supreme Court's decision in Tuma has on how we view Brady material? It seems to me they're pretty well gutted. Impeachment, as you know, in that case there were inconsistent statements made by the victim that were disclosed, and I guess there were issues about diligence on the part of counsel and whatnot. But it seems to me the Supreme Court pretty well made it very difficult to use impeachment material as a post-trial Brady remedy.
I do think Tuma is problematic as a defense attorney and specifically in this case. But again, I think the fact, I keep coming back to it, I don't want to repeat myself, but I think it's important. The fact that this is a firearms charge coming to light after a defendant has already been convicted of a firearms-related case where her closeness and her veracity, closeness to the firearm, her veracity about her testimony is of utmost importance, that's what I think is key here. That's what I think is why this is important impeachment evidence.
That counts. You still have your rebuttal time, so.
Certainly, and the court didn't ask any questions about sufficiency, but I would rely on my brief for that.
You see that to be the case. Ms. Robichin.
May it please the court, Chris Obenchain representing the Commonwealth in this matter. Your Honor, I think what we're dealing with here is that appellant is attempting to basically create a new exception for firearms charges in order to be able to use those to impeach a witness's credibility. And the witness's credibility is really what we're talking about here, because the trial court found that there was no agreement between the Commonwealth. There was no exchange between the Commonwealth, and certainly the evidence showed that Ms. Harkless never received any benefit from the police or from the Commonwealth's attorney in this case. And so...
Well, counsel, let me interrupt you and see how you deal with Ms. Burroughs' specific argument. It seems to me this really comes down, the Brady issue comes down to, we have unadjudicated conduct, you know, pending charges, presumption of innocence. Nevertheless, the law is also clear. You can be, under the right circumstances, you can be cross-examined for unadjudicated or prior bad acts type conduct. And so the question is, does this fall within that category? and if not, why not? And I guess from your perspective, if not, why not? And then what's the effect on a Brady analysis of all that?
Yes, Your Honor. The for the purpose of impeaching a witness's credibility, it's clear that unadjudicated charges, I think the court has pretty clearly ruled that unadjudicated charges can't be used to impeach a witness's credibility. We're looking at felonies, we're looking at crimes of moral turpitude. These charges don't fall into either of those categories. Now, certainly they could be impeachable information could be used to attack the witness's bias or motive to fabricate. But I think if you look at the facts of this case, we're not dealing with either one of these scenarios. And I think the cases that Mr. Hicklin relies upon, Banks and Giglio, you look at those cases, those are cases involving informants or individuals who have prior dealings with government agents, prior dealings that weren't disclosed. That's not what we have in this case. What they're asking for is pending charges that are completely unrelated to the crime that is being charged here and the crime for which the person is testifying. And furthermore, I mean, I would note the Commonwealth apparently wasn't even aware of these charges at that point in time. Obviously, knowledge that the police has is imputed to the Commonwealth under Brady, but I think that goes to the fact that that this wasn't something that could have been used to impeach the witness's bias or motive to fabricate. There was no reason for Ms. Harkless to fabricate her testimony, and none was advanced at the trial court. No reason was advanced that this charge in this other jurisdiction that was an assault and battery, these misdemeanor pending charges, would have caused her to fabricate her testimony in this case. They weren't related to the same person. And furthermore, Mr. Hicklin never advanced any theory at trial, such as self-defense, that was related to, would have been related to that type of charge. So I think the trial court found that this wasn't impeachable evidence. Our position is that was a correct finding, that they weren't required to turn over pending charges that had nothing to do with this case, and that weren't the subject of any type of agreement between the Commonwealth and the witness. And the scenarios that the court addressed in Banks and in Giglio are completely different because there's already an existing relationship between the witness and the government. And then furthermore, the court made a clear finding on materiality in this case. And I think the law is quite clear that where the court makes this finding, that the evidence was not material, it wouldn't have affected the outcome, and that finding was not unreasonable in this case for a couple of reasons. First of all, there was already evidence that would have gone to the witness's credibility, and the information about the other charges in Hopewell, the court said that was even more relevant than these other pending charges to the witness's credibility, and that when the court looked at the testimony, even in light of that false report charge, listening to the testimony of the witness of Harkless was believable. The testimony of the witness of Hicklin's testimony was not believable, and furthermore, there was physical evidence that supported Harkless's testimony, didn't support Hicklin's version of events that occurred, and so the court found her testimony to be credible. And the court already had this information that could have been used, that could have impeached her testimony, but didn't find it sufficient to, destroy her credibility with regard to her testimony in this case. And so it wasn't unreasonable for the court to find that these other pending charges, which again, she hadn't been convicted of, wouldn't have affected her credibility any further and would have done nothing to discount the physical evidence in the case and the testimony of the officer as well. So I think that the materiality finding is significant in this case, and the court's ruling as to the Brady matter should be affirmed.
Do you want to address the Ms. Burrow's plea regarding the suppression matter, whether as a public record this evidence was suppressed by the Commonwealth?
Your Honor, I would.
She makes a point clearly that it would be. I mean, I guess the Brady part of the analysis would be, in terms of suppression, would be whether, with due diligence, the information could reasonably have been ascertained otherwise. And if that's the case, that it wasn't suppressed by the Commonwealth. I understand your position to be, well, it's a public record, end of analysis. I'm not sure it's really that simple.
Well, I think that the issue is that this information was equally discoverable by both the Commonwealth and the defense.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I used to be a prosecutor in my youth, prosecutors have available all the criminal history information, you know, basically nationwide, at the touch of a button on a computer. Criminal defense attorneys generally don't. They have to, you know, go to courthouses where there are indeed public records, but we have a lot of courthouses in the Commonwealth, and that doesn't even count all the ones around the country. And if you have to go to every courthouse to examine their public records to determine if someone's got a conviction or charges pending, that's a pretty burdensome effort, it seems to me.
Well, I understand where the court is coming from there, and as a former prosecutor myself, I understand where what the court is saying. I think in this instance, what we're talking about again is pending charges, and pending charges don't always show up on the criminal record immediately.
Well, I was also a former defense attorney, and I didn't get access to criminal records unless the government gave them to me, so as part of discovery. So, I mean, you know, it's definitely not a level playing field when it comes to access to criminal history information.
Well, and I think the facts of this case, Your Honor, are such that, you know, the Commonwealth obviously, I think it appears in the record, the Commonwealth's attorney wasn't aware of her pending charges in the other jurisdiction. Mr. Hicklin's attorney actually found out about them before the Commonwealth's attorney did,
Well, the problem is the Commonwealth attorney is charged with the knowledge the police department has. It's imputed knowledge. So if it's exculpatory
I think it goes back to that issue, Your Honor, is that these are pending charges that couldn't have been used to impeach the witness's credibility. They weren't relevant. They weren't relevant to any bias or motive to fabricate in this case because they were completely unrelated to this case, and no bias, no argument for a bias or motive to fabricate was ever advanced I think the evidence that actually was in front of the court that was argued was more significant to those issues than this information that they're asking for, because you had evidence that that Ms. Harkless got out of her car, and she admitted she got out of her car and you know ran her car into his car, beat the car with a crowbar, and things of that nature. Obviously, that type of information was much more significant in terms of her bias against the defendant, or her motive to fabricate, or her impeachment, and the court considered all that. And so I think that's, again, a reason why the court's finding that this information wouldn't have had a reasonable probability of changing the outcome of the case was not unreasonable, because there was so much information already through the testimony of the witnesses, the information that had already been disclosed. And I think the fact that the Commonwealth disclosed information that it wasn't even necessarily required to in terms of the other pending charges in Hopewell, or in Hanover, I believe, shows that the Commonwealth clearly was making an effort to disclose everything that they knew about. And so the court's finding on that materiality peg of Brady was not unreasonable. And again, nothing was directly connected to this charge. There wasn't any existing relationship. As opposed to the Workman case, where it was proffered what evidence the undisclosed information could have led to that was impeachable, we don't have any kind of proffer or anything in this case where this information could have led to some other evidence that could have been used for impeachment. And just to touch on the point that was raised regarding the reasonable hypothesis of innocence, there was no other hypothesis of innocence that was raised. His defense was, I never had a gun. His defense wasn't self-defense. It wasn't, she had a gun. In fact, Hicklin testified that she didn't have a gun. And so this idea that if they had known this information, they could have found out something else that would have changed the outcome of the case doesn't comport with what the evidence was in this case. His defense was just, I never had a gun. The trial court, listened to all the evidence, was entitled to believe her account of events because they were, again, supported by the physical evidence, and specifically did not believe his account of events, which was inconsistent with the physical evidence. And so this idea that somehow her charges, her unrelated, unadjudicated charges in another jurisdiction would have impeached her any more than she already was impeached through cross-examination and through the information that was already disclosed, I don't think is supported by the evidence. And for those reasons, we ask the court to affirm the trial court's decision as well as to affirm the conviction based upon the sufficiency of the evidence, which we will rely on our brief for that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Overchain. Ms. Burroughs?
Yes. First, I would like to address the fact that Commonwealth talked about what Mr. Hicklin's testimony was. I think what I appreciate as a defense attorney about the Brady standard is that we're not required to show that the outcome would have been different. And I think that is fair to us because information like this, especially in a case such as this one, could have changed a lot of different things. It could have changed how cross-examination was handled. It could have changed the decision whether Mr. Hicklin wanted to testify or not. So that could have changed what the evidence was. It could have changed what the defense theory was. So I think the fact that, our defense was X doesn't really have any bearing on whether this is a Brady issue. The fact is, we found out later on, the entire case hinges on this, whether or not there was a firearm in the car, and a lot of that was tied to there being a bullet hole in the car. This charge in Hopewell was Brady evidence because that could have impeached her testimony as to how that bullet hole got there. She's charged in Hopewell with having a firearm in her hand and firing that firearm into a car, no less. So I think that is where our impeachment issue comes in. That is where her motive to fabricate comes in, and that's why this is a Brady issue. That's why it's Brady material, and that's why it should have been turned over. I think it's fairly clear. It's fairly straightforward. I'm not asking the court to make new law. I'm just asking the court to apply the law as it stands with Brady. The court clearly found, or I think the court should clearly find, that this was favorable evidence. It was suppressed from defense counsel prior to trial. And the trial court's reasoning or the trial court's decision as to materiality was unreasonable given the Giglio standard. And for those reasons, I would ask the court to reverse and remand for a new trial.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Burroughs. We're going to come down and recap.